Rich. Just like to say a few things about the AXPT effort. This was another one of these programs that we did on the cheap by getting about 800 AXPTs for basically free from Army Depot site in Nevada, where a lot of these XPTs are demilled and cut up into shrapnel. And it turns out that the deal is every 5 years, the various AXPT contractors around the country get to bid on a new contract. And when they manufacture these things, whoever wins, it's got a 5-year lifetime. So in 5 years, whatever they have in stock around the world goes to Hawthorne, Nevada. And they work just fine. They last about 15 years, especially in the desert. So anyway, that's what we wound up using here. So what we did, our effort was, again, to make a contribution to observing the ocean response from the airborne platform, putting VTs with respect to the storm, where we thought they'd be most useful. Hopefully, one of the key reasons that the meteorologist has for doing this is detecting where the warm and cold eddies are and what impact these features, oceanographic features, may have on density change, especially rapid intensity, intensification and rapid decay as well. So that was our effort to contribute from the F1 platform that way. So the intent was to use the WC-130J flown by the 53rd piece of the Air Force Base to deploy these probes. We utilized two aircraft. This year we had, last year we had two full crews, so it gave us the flexibility of being able to do back-to-back flights, which we did near the end of the project. And then another effort was also undertaken to coordinate our flights directly with the Dartstar Astra aircraft, which we were successful in doing. I think in TCS-08 it kind of happened by accident, but this time we took out the phone. I pulled the trench out of bed more than one time at 3 o'clock in the morning to coordinate flight patterns. And that was an effort. I think it worked out real good because we were able to fly the intercore drop XPTs and SONs while the Dartstar flew around the perimeter measuring what's going on in the atmosphere and getting a better handle on the kinds of things that Pat Hart talked about. There's shear. In fact, this program worked out so good that NPO, the NTU, wants to build a sort of a mini AXPT system for the Dartstar in the future to be able to do these combo deployments that we have been doing for ITOP and TCS-08. I'll kind of just skip over this, but this is kind of a comparison of TCS-08 and ITOP in terms of aircraft, expendables, instrumentation. We didn't have the NRLP-3 this year. That was TCS-08 and the Dartstar. This is, again, statistical summary of flight hours, missions, high-level missions, so on and so forth. A total of 7 storms between the two projects. You've all seen this from Eric's program plan. Just a summary of operations that were planned to coordinate the aircraft and ships, satellite observations, including this is a typical flight pattern that was flown in Fanopy relative to the IR image there from Jeff's website. And see the green flight track was the Dartstar, and our flight pattern was in the blue. And that strategy worked out real good. I keep telling Shunshe that I almost got thrown in jail for this particular photo. I was deemed to have breached the base security. So I almost wound up in a brig. That was just one of the many little fun things about running the program now. But then all those brouhaha that died down after about 2 weeks. So it worked out good, and they have a nice crew to fly the Astra airplane. So, main thing we had to do, we began in TCSOA, and we're able to get some additional support from Ron at ONR to complete a dual system of recording and processing the HPT data in real time. So with this system of boxes, we're all rack-mounted, shock-mounted, portable. We could carry them on and off the aircraft. And in fact, for that flight that Eric talked about for the internal tides, we launched a record number of 76 AXPTs and sent them all back in real time, and only because we took both of our science crew, both of our assistants here, were able to record all that data in real time. So the probes are launched out of the back of the airplane with this nice launch, very simple launch tube system that Robert Lee, former Chief Master Sergeant, designed many years ago. And he was nice enough to put that design into the specifications for the C-130J model when they got these new airplanes a few years back. So that's, we find that it makes a huge difference in the success rate, launching them out the back of the airplane like this rather than other way it's done in the P-3 where they're either fired out by an explosive charge or a free-fall launched into the airstream, both of which cause a big shock to the electronics. And also have the capability for deploying all those drifters that Peter and Eric and the floats that Eric and Tom put together out the back end of the C-130. I don't have much on that. But these are the three storms that we flew. These are minimum pressure and maximum wind estimates from various satellite techniques compared with the observations from the aircraft. The SATCON system, Satellite Consensus, has done a remarkably good job that Jeff and Chris Felden put together. And we had some additional opportunities to validate that in the Western Pacific, which has not occurred very much in the past. So, here is some observations provided by EE, where she took cargo float data and plotted up sample profiles for the three different storms, Panopy, Malakas, and Medjay. And you can see they represent three very distinctly different oceanographic regions of the Western Pacific. Panopy was a Cat 3, Malakas Cat 2, and Medjay a Super Typhoon Cat 5. This is an example of some of the flight patterns we flew. For example, early in Panopy, deploying NHPTs in something we call a square spiral pattern that provided a grid of data, either 5 or 6 degrees on a side, depending how much flight pattern you get. And with each of these squares, what made this especially important was that we were able to document the ocean structure as the storm was developing. I am becoming more and more convinced that even for developing systems, the underlying ocean conditions can be either helping or hurting storm development. And in this particular case, it was interesting for us because the storm tracked right across the boundary between the very deep, warm ocean layers and the south side of the West Pacific and the colder waters north of there. This is superimposed on the ocean heat front and provided by Dong Shan Ko as initial conditions for the Stennis ocean model. As the storm developed, one of the interesting things occurred is as it took that jog to the northeast that several people have shown, it happened to be right up a tongue of actually a warm water or warm anticyclonic eddy, just where the storm began its intensification. And it continued that major storm as it turned back to the left over cold eddy. So Malakas and Pat's already showed you these flight tracks. Along each one of them, we have again a series of AXPTs. And in Medjay, we flew two phases of this project, the storm. One was the developing stages where we flew square spiral again and then transitioned to what we call a butterfly pattern, storm centric, and continued deploying AXPTs and SONs. And then during the super typhoon stage, 17th of October, just a few days before the project ended, we were able to take observations that showed again, a very interesting pattern of underlying ocean conditions with a cold eddy feature to the northeast, which was rapidly cooled further by the storm, and a warm tongue treating up to about the storm center to the left of the storm track. This is the post-storm pattern that I talked about in the previous talk with Floyd Daniels, the CPDs. And again, you can see that the pattern sort of straddled these two predominant features. And I don't mean to steal Jeff's thunder, he'll talk more about this shortly, but the square spiral pattern we use in the developing stages of canopy proved to be especially interesting in documenting the ocean features, the conditions in the ocean at the same time that were documenting what happened in the atmosphere. So one of the things I did, as Eric mentioned, I didn't know beans about internal tides in the ocean in the Western Pacific, and so I got a heart attack when Peter Neela grabbed me and said, you've got to take these things into account. So to give you an idea of the variability, this is the range of profiles that, that take place in the internal tide flight that Eric talked about. Fanopy warm cold eddy flight on the 13th, again, a large range from shallow profiles to very deep but flat profiles, and then over the warm eddy feature on the 14th as the storm continues to develop. And I'm going to run out of time here, but Jeff will talk about this. Let me skip over it real quick. It shows the development of energy from an open wave to a low-level circulation here on the 13th to a tropical cyclone. And,
just have 3 minutes.
Okay. Again, the thing I wanted to emphasize with this is the ocean conditions while Fanopy was developing. That one feature by the Taiwan Buoy A1, which unfortunately I guess wasn't working at this time, but that's where Fanopy developed. And then to the right of the storm was a cold eddy, which developed into the cold wake, became part of the cold wake documented by Eden's POTUS analysis. So I compared that with the way Jeff does things in NRL on both the 19th and the 20th document, essentially a little bit different views of how that whole wake developed. So I think the main thing is we're becoming more and more aware, especially in the Western Pacific, that these eddy features have a huge role to play in tropical cyclone decay and intensification, and probably could be a big missing ingredient to the way intensity forecasts are being made right now, essentially ignoring all this information. So cold eddies are detrimental, warm eddies are helpful, and we hope to be able to transition this kind of a strategy where we do a combo AXPT and buffs on the deployments to the Atlantic for the 53rd to do on a routine basis there, even though the eddy features in the Atlantic are not as energetic as the Pacific. Now, where we stand on processing is really two phases that we're going through on the QC with the AXPTs. One is there are numerous errors in ET location that we're in the process of correcting. When we plot them up on Google Earth, they stand out like a sore thumb. Just have to go through the data set. Correct those. There's a few that have a bad time stamp as well. That has to be corrected. And we think by the inside of a week or two, all that should be done, and that first cut on the data set should be a year well and ready for people to use. But the second phase, you have to be aware of. There are three other sources of error. One is a calibration correction between to convert the frequency observed to temperature. And sometimes, depending on the probe type we use, between Hermes or Spartan, they can have slightly different equations. And there's also the drop and fall rate can be a little bit different. You have to check on that. And then, there's another problem with late starting on some of the recording. We have to go back and reprocess the audio files. Fix that. So that's going to take a little longer, maybe by the end of the summer, we'll have that done. That's it from our data products. That essentially is pretty much ready to go. Pat's got a student that's checking it out to doing a statistical regression between the surface dropsonde observations and the surface winds and emissivities measured by SFMR to surface wind calculations. So these are just a list of some of the ancillary observations that we had in mind. But we're working hard to get this data out to everybody. I know several folks are waiting very patiently. Thanks.
Okay, we have time for a simple question.
So, in oceans where you do have thermal waves, how rapidly could you toss those AHPTs out? So we need to resolve one. Can you even listen to them? They send back the signal to the frequency. You would shoot one up and the other one up.
There's three different frequencies that we use. So you can sort of stay out at the same time. That's the fact that that internal wave flight would drop them out every 4 or 5 minutes. And the two crews and two systems, that worked out pretty good, because by the time you get on to the third HPT launch, the first one usually descended to 1,000 meters and the wire broke and stopped transmitting. So it actually worked out pretty good. And that is a concern. Something anybody that uses these data is going to have to take into account the internal tides. And I can't say as I know how to do that exactly. Maybe using one of your tidal models to get a handle on what the phase of tide change is with respect to when you make the observations with a typical flight can span 4 to 6 hours, which is a half of semi-annual tidal period. So it's trying to interpret what the HPTs mean. I think some thoughts going to need to be given to that as well.
Okay, let's move on. Chair, any questions?